was news just yesterday that the ex-Irish Navy ship, the Ellie Ashling, is now in the hands of a Libyan warlord and operating off the coast of that country. It was sold to Libya by a company in the United Arab Emirates in breach of UN Security Council arms embargoes. Before she went on the market, the Ashling was stripped of all her weaponry and it was sold by the auctioneer Dominic Daly. It went to a Dutch company for €110,000 before being sold on. Dominic told me what happened.
Well, I sold her, as is, as seen. And by saying that, people possibly don't understand that when you sell a naval ship, she doesn't have any papers.
What does that mean?
Well, a ship has to have registration and class. An Irish naval ship, you just give the purchaser a bill of sale. They then have to go away and they have to establish class for her so she can be certified and insured, etc., etc., etc.
So when you sold it, it went to a Dutch broker?
A Dutch broker. And he couldn't even take it away. He had to tow it away because the paperwork wasn't in order. He could have taken her to a dry dock in Ireland and done all the necessary upgrading to get class for insurance, but he chose to get an ocean-going tug to tow her to Holland.
He had her there for quite some time?
He did. And he renamed her and obviously got class for her.
What do you understand as to what happened next?
As far as I know, he sold her. He sold her to some Arab people who I think sold her on to Libyan people.
So it's now owned by a Libyan warlord. It's been up-armoured again?
Yes. Well, she was nearly 40 years old. It's questionable whether you'd want to rearm something like that. You know, steel deteriorates when it's in salt water. There aren't many 40-year-old ships being used as warships at present.
An Irish naval ship being sold, it doesn't have any papers. How does that come about?
Maybe for security reasons. They prefer to do their own thing rather than have class and certification. That's always been the way. There's nothing new in that.
What kind of work had to be done to the Ashling when she was sold?
I think you would need to go into dry dock. You need to draw the shafts, do a sonic tests on the hull, just to establish certification for her.
So are we talking a couple of million, a couple of hundred thousand?
A few hundred thousand.
Are you selling anything else at the moment, now that I have you here?
I don't have anything at present. But you never know. Okay, you might come in tomorrow.
Auctioning ships in Ireland, it's a main part of your business.
It's a niche. I started over 40 years ago. A solicitor in Cork came to me and asked me, would I undertake the sale of a cargo vessel in Cork? And I said, why are you coming to me? And he said, well, I've asked the people in Dublin who used to do this and they don't appear to be interested. You seem to have some knowledge of boats and ships. Would you take this on for me? And it went on from there.
And how do you go about selling a ship?
Well, I've built up quite a big database of contacts, of different brokers and agents, of people who are interested, and it's all over the world. If I showed it to you, it would make very interesting reading, okay. All the different people who are interested. Yeah.
Is it a big market worldwide, or is it very, very specialised?
It's varied. I mean, sometimes you have a cargo vessel, other times you might have a yacht. It depends the segment you're in.
What's the most memorable sale you've had?
Many years ago, I sold a reefer down in Castletown Bear. It was called the Bardini Reefer. And it was in some sort of financial difficulties between two different parties. And I sold it for much more than we expected. And then it subsequently sank in Castletown Bear. And you can still see its masts.
What's a reefer and what's its name?
The Bardini Reefer. A reefer is a ship for storing fish that are caught offshore and transporting it to mainland.
If I remember correctly, it's in the middle of the sound there and the masts are sticking right up.
That's right. Two masts are still sticking right up.
Auctioneer Dominic Daly on the Ellie Ashling. We'll be keeping an eye on it. Christmas is the time of year which sees many books published, and in recent weeks I've been sent several about maritime issues in Ireland. One of the glossiest has been put out by the Department of Communications, Climate Action and Environment, called RMS Lusitania, The Story of a Wreck. We all know the story. The Lusitania was the largest and fastest ocean-going liner in the world when she was launched in 1906. She was sunk by a submarine in 1915 with a huge loss of life. This book provides a new approach to the story, drawing on new research and new technology. There is expertise from the Geological Survey of Ireland and the Maritime Institute of Ireland, and in collaboration with the National Monuments Service and the National Museum of Ireland. It's for sale at €20 and it's a really glossy production. A similarly glossy affair is a book published just last night. It's Sailing Ships of Wexford from the 1840s to the 1940s. Written by Jack O'Leary and Brian Clear, it covers the registration, the owners and history of those sailing ships, complete with pictures, maps and drawings. It covers 200 ships of the area and has the logs of three Wexford ships as well. It was launched at the Wexford Library last night and is available in the Book Centre in Wexford and in Waterford and from other local publishers at €30. One book we featured recently on the programme is Round Ireland by Slowboat by Richard Kennedy. It recounts his journey, along with his wife Rita, around the island over two sailing seasons in the boat Shockrone. It's available in many outlets or you can order it on Facebook, Round Ireland by Slowboat. And just last week, we featured a book recounting the centenary of the Baltimore Lifeboat by Eamon Langford. Baltimore Lifeboat, a community story, is available from the RNLI and locally in West Cork. It's €16. Another local book is Catching the Past, Folklore and Legend of Maritime Howth. All proceeds of this will go to the establishment of a maritime museum in Howth, and it's also available locally. One book we've mentioned here a number of times is At the Water's Edge by the late Timmy Flavin. It recounts his journey around Ireland by kayak in 1991. It's a beautiful production with maps and photographs and is Timmy's diary of the time. We've had a number of readings from it over the past few weeks, and here Brian Lally again takes up Timmy's journey. This time he's on the northwest coast.
Day 16. Sunday, 26th of May, 91. Dogs Bay to Clare Island. Lazy about getting up at 06:30 on the water for 8 o'clock. By today, we will have used up all food. Not that we will starve, but we will be paddling without good food. Want to make a push for Ackle and Tim Daly's food dump. An excellent day. Rounded Sline Head and watch compass swing north. Unusual work in picking a route through a thousand islets, channels, etc. Like a maze, hoping your channel will not be a dead end or will not be low, but will lead to open water. Pulled into Clare Island to stay after stopping at different islands on the way up to eat. It'll be lovely to tour this area, but time is not on our side. Passed loads of fishing crafts on the way and liberally applied sun lotions as the day was a scorcher. The last 2 hours to Clare were rough as the wind rose from the north directly in our faces and picking up the sea. Got in about 21:30. And went for a meal at the local hotel. Salmon and tea. Excellent value and reasonable. Day 19. Wednesday, 29th of May. Port O'Cloy to Iskey. We are on the water at 09:30, our latest start, but well fed and warm in the sun. Even though the wind and tide are against us, we make good distance. Our mathematical calculations last evening told us we need to do 35 to 37 miles daily to be in with a chance. This wind against tide makes for big breaking seas. We bob around like corks for a few hours and make a 1700 lunch stop in a lovely bay. It has a stone pier and sloped steps. Nudist beach is written on the wall. I must go there some sunny day. We talk to some fishermen and what seems to be a common complaint around the coast crops up again. Namely, civil servants from Dublin deciding on the design of the pier or the placement and type of machinery all against the better judgment of the local users. Here, the boys from Dublin had removed a perfect hand winch and installed a generator-driven one, which the locals said wouldn't pull our kayaks, let alone their big boats. Day 21. Friday, 31st of May. port to bloody foreland. Slept until 0700, definitely very tired. On the water after 9, helped on by the midges. They are really agonising. Really fantastic scenery starting off. Ideal touring country. Huge cliffs, small beaches, crags, caves, etc. A day of island hopping with fog banks. Made Arnmore for lunch and lunch on pier. No sun and cold with wind and sea mist all around. Decided to cut inside Cruet Island as the tide was rising and to be out of wind against the tide. I saw no sign of Donal or his boat, no slipway pier or easy landing. I assume Donal has moved on, and as it is now dusk, it was getting harder to see. I ended up paddling around Bloody Foreland and having a difficult landing on a boulder beach. Once changed, I walked back the cliff top to look out for Donal. Met him looking likewise for me. He had forced a landing as it was getting dark and his arms were in trouble. He saw me coming into the bay and assumed I was following in. The fact that we had split up caused problems for both of us. Had one of us got in trouble? Should we call in help? Donal had to pitch the tent on boulders, most uncomfortable. He had his sleeping bag and bivy bag. I had the tent inner and his oilskins. We spent an unpleasant few hours until it was light enough for me to walk back to my boat. Donal was then able to get some comfort from his oilskins and tent inner. Once back, I found a 6-foot slab and had a good sleep on it, certainly better than Donal's spot. When Donal awoke, he had no concept of the time he had slept and dressed immediately to paddle around to me and to find me in a perfect bed. Day 22, June 1st, Bloody Foreland to Rockstown. On the water at 7:15, a nearly start due to our circumstances and having to make our rendezvous for tonight. Flat but dead paddling and cold. Both seem dead in the water. Each paddle stroke is used to restart the movement. Pulled into a boulder beach under Hornhead. Loads of driftwood. Lit a bonfire to dry out our clothes and heat ourselves up. Boiled up milk for cocoa. Had a lot to eat. Paddled on in a lazy swell, in and out of fog, using t-shirts as head protection from both sun and for heat. I am very tired. Would love to pull in and go to sleep, but we have to make progress. Eventually the tide turns with us and we make good distance for the last 90 minutes.
At the water's edge, Two Boats Around Ireland by Kayak by Timmy Flavin is priced at €15. Copies are available directly from his wife, Breed Farrell, at an email address, breedofarrell@icloud.com. All proceeds to cancer charities. One book I received just this week is called Cork Harbour by Cal McCarthy. Published by Merriam Press, it's another lavish production and it tells the story of one of the largest natural harbours in the world. Cork, as we know, has a long history with the British Navy, and this book recounts the full history of the harbour through military and trade and its association with convict transports to Australia. It's full of maps and illustrations and it's priced at £29.95. And just two more books. Stories from the Deep is by scuba diver and filmmaker Ken O'Sullivan. You'll remember Ken from the RTE documentary series Ireland's Deep Atlantic last year. For that programme, Ken filmed many species of whales off the west coast of Ireland and further afield for the first time. Stories from the Deep is his personal journey and is published by Gill Books at £16.99. And finally is a book, The Summer Isles, by Philip Marsden. It's a beautifully written account by British author Philip Marsden as he recreates his journey from Cornwall up through the islands of Scotland and the west of Ireland following the footsteps of Celtic monks. It's published by Granta. It's £20. A couple of weeks ago, the programme came from the National Maritime College of Ireland, and there we met many people who were both involved in education and who were trying to recruit students for various shipping and cruising companies. Another of the people I met there was Joy Gillen of GAC Training and Service Solutions. They have a unique bespoke training facility in the college, and she told me about it.
So what we do is the niche training, bespoke training for companies. Anyone at sea will come back here and they might do different things from simulation training. They might do replenishment at sea, ship-to-ship transfers, and then they would use our 360 simulator to do their training. It's a full mission bridge, Consberg Sim. and they would do various different courses.
That's quite a bit of technological terms. Just explain what you said to me.
Sure. So depending on the industry, let's say we would work with seismic companies. So they might be out looking for new pockets of oil in the sea, and they would be out in different various vessels with streamers. They would then need, let's say, replenishment at sea, whether it is something for on board the vessel, it could be food, it could be crew coming on board, they'll be doing different transfers. So the pilots on these vessels need to know how to come up to the main mothership, let's say, come slide along at sea while the ship might be still moving, and then they will learn how to do these courses here. So we'll be looking at senior officers and ship's masters. They would come here and practice those maneuvers here in our simulator so that, you know, they get, you know, to have, basically make the mistakes here under, you know, no environmental or loss of life threat, anything like that. They can train here and learn the different various maneuvers, practice them over and over again before they go to sea and do them there.
So these are people who have already started on their career. They may be graduates from here a couple of years before.
Absolutely. So you'll be looking at the ship's officers. So that would be on the deck side of things. But what we also do is bespoke courses for various different companies. Let's say beside us here now, we've got TK. TK are one of our customers here at the college. They would come here and we would do courses such as safe operations training or leadership courses or CPD courses for their masters and chief engineers. So we talk to the clients and we see what kind of courses they want, and we develop a bespoke course tailored to suit their exact specifications.
And you run it here in the college?
We do indeed.
Are these your facilities here? So you have lifeboat launch, fire safety, several other things?
Absolutely. So it's really a state-of-the-art facility because everything's on the one campus, which is, you know, unique enough in this day and age for a training centre. So they might be out in our jetty on our free fall or the twin fall boats, fast rescue boats. They might do man overboard exercise, and then they might come in and next thing we'll do a simulation. We'll have a scenario, let's say, where there's been a fire, and they'll go to the fire yard, and we have various different fires down there. So it might be flange, it could be various different, you know, chemicals and fire used. They'll put out a fire, and then let's say they might do an abandonment exercise. So let's say, okay, that's it, the fire has, you know, spread, and now we're going to do abandoned ship. So they will run up to our pool and do various different things there, like they'll jump from the platform into the water, they'll learn how to enter a life raft safely, basically looking out for one another, working as a team, making sure that nobody's drifting apart when they're in the water, because it's a sea survival pool, it's not a swimming pool. Yeah. So we've wind, waves, thunder, lightning, you know, so it's really realistic, and it's very much a controlled environment with our instructors, you know, making sure that everyone is very, very safe, but it's a very, very realistic environment, which is what we want, you know, for, you know, it needs to be as real as possible, but obviously in a controlled environment. So, and we'll do all those courses tailored to each company's own procedures. So we'll work with the company, we'll learn their different procedures, regardless what company it is, we'll meet with them, and then we'll develop those courses based on their own procedures. And obviously, you know, the standards, the industry standards then for safety as well. So, yeah.
Your trainees here, were they mostly Irish, from Irish companies, or do they come from all over the world?
Actually, they come from all over the world. So, yeah, so we have people from everywhere, all over the world, training with us. So it's very much global.
And the facilities you have here are second to none on campus?
They really are. There's fantastic facilities, and they're always being updated. And, you know, I've been to training centres all over the world, and, you know, the NMCI is definitely a very special place, and the facilities here are fantastic. They really are.
And that was Joy Gillen of GAC Training and Service Solutions at the National Maritime College of Ireland. This month, Dublin City Council voted to build a white water rafting facility in the Docklands of Dublin at a cost of €24 million. But just across the River Liffey is a huge, vastly underused waterway, the Grand Canal Dock. A regular contributor, Hugh Orme, went down there to have a look.
The vast expanse of water that makes up the Grand Canal Docks on the south side of the River Liffey, close to Dublin city centre, has been almost entirely unused for years, but there are signs that all that may be about to change. These docks are very old, dating back to 1796. When they were opened, they were the largest docks in the world, but within 5 decades they'd fallen into disuse, mainly because of the arrival of the railways. When the Dublin Gas Company started, it used much of the land around the docks for storing mountains of coal for gas making. Other factories were established in the area, many with a very detrimental effect on the environment, making bottles, chemicals, iron and tar. However, in complete contrast, bread baking became an industry on the southern edge of the Inner Basin. But for well over a century, the waters of the Grand Canal docks remained almost completely unused, so much so that by the 1960s they were entirely derelict. Regeneration didn't begin until the late 1990s, when Bord Gáis sold the former gasworks site in the area to the Dublin Docklands Development Authority. Work began on the hugely expensive and costly task of decontaminating the land surrounding the docks. And work then began on property development in the area beside the docks, creating homes for several thousand residents. And about 20 years ago, a €1.5 billion development plan was launched for the area, but it was all land-based. Little, if any, of the money was spent on the water, so the actual docks remained unused. One of the places bought up for redevelopment then was the old riverfront studio on Hanover Quay that belonged to the U2 group. Among the new buildings constructed in the area were the Alto Vetro and the Millennium Tower apartment buildings, the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre, and alongside that theatre, an office building designed by world-renowned architect Daniel Libeskind. Airbnb got premises on Hanover Quay. But some of those developments didn't happen. The National College of Ireland was due to move to the area in 2001, but didn't, instead relocating near the IFSC on the other side of the Liffey. And one well-known manufacturing firm that opened at Hanover Quay in 1953 was Raleigh Cycles, eventually closing down in 1980 with the loss of 540 jobs. The other day I walked all around the perimeter of the Grand Canal docks to see exactly what had been done on their landward side and how untouched the actual water is by any development. Today, Hanover Quay itself is populated with cafes and shops, thronged with visitors, yet close by is a long warehouse that remains boarded up. Some of the lock gates that connect the two sections of the Grand Canal docks are in a decrepit condition with badly rotted timbers. Yet right in the middle of the locks is the well-maintained lockkeeper's house. Despite all the building activity in recent years surrounding the Grand Canal docks, little if anything has been done so far to animate the vast stretches of water in the docks. True, during the most recent Halloween, the docks had a wonderful light display to mark the event. But among the few boats moored on the docks at the moment is the Brian Boru sail training vessel. But Waterways Ireland is acutely aware of the disuse into which the waters of the Grand Canal docks have fallen and is making plans to develop multi-uses for the docks itself. Maureen O'Curoin is the Dublin Docklands Development Manager at Waterways Ireland, and she says that plans for development of the water space in the docks are being developed at the moment. She adds that some decisions are due to be made in early 2020 about upgrading water-based activities in the docks, including plans to get the lock gates back into use and to create an extended boardwalk for the whole perimeter of the lock. As further developments take place, access to the docks as well as parking will need to be improved. But she adds there are no plans for anything similar to the whitewater rafting centre now being developed at George's Dock on the other side of the river. However, she agrees that Grand Canal Docks is a fantastic stretch of water, but that it could take 3 to 5 years for developments to take place. Small, modest events are planned for 2020, but no big infrastructural investments are planned immediately. It's all a question of finding the right mix of water-based activities, she concludes. One ongoing activity that's always vital is ensuring that the water quality in the docks is maintained. The Grand Canal docks are a fantastic stretch of water, but so underutilised for so long. But now, at long last, there are definite signs that the situation is about to change, and that before too long, we could see some exciting new water-based activities taking place there.
Hugh Oram.